Good morning. We often hear of the unimaginable amount of plastic swirling around the ocean. A new study suggests there is a lot less of it. Today, UH researcher Dave Carl looks at why that's not such good news. In the debate over a Kawanui Marsh development plan, the state says some of the opposition's talking points are erroneous. DLNR wildlife biologist Jim Cogswell wants to be sure we're discussing the same facts. We'll talk later this hour.
Summer isn't the time most people like to spend a lot of time in the kitchen, but it just might be the right time to hone your cooking skills in someone else's culinary castle. The Blonde Vegetarian, aka Chef Rebecca Woodland, will give you the chance. And it wouldn't be summer on Kauai without Koloa Plantation Days. We'll get a preview of this year's celebration. I'm Chris Vanderbilt.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. On Monday, July 7th, it's The Conversation. Now, the news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
New findings about plastic in the ocean. I can't tell if it's good news or not so good news.
Well, that's sort of the question about this study. Now, no doubt you've heard about the Great Pacific Garbage Dump. Now it seems there's the Great Pacific Garbage Dump mystery. A new survey found 99% less ocean plastic than researchers expected to document. There's also speculation now that the plastic bits may be finding their way into the bellies of fish and possibly ours. We called the Inouye Center for Microbial Oceanography Research and Education at the University of Hawaii. David Carl is the center's director, and he's here with his read of the study. Good morning. Thanks for coming in, Dave.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Looking at this study, which is pretty extensive, leaving Spain, virtually going around the world, checking the ocean at various points, was it somewhat of a red herring, but the idea of looking for as much plastic as we thought would be there, or was that simply because we'd only checked the ocean in specific spots where there was so much plastic?
Yeah, this is a real problem with the plastic pollution on the planet, Beth Ann. We estimate how much plastic is going into the ocean from measurements that are made in coastal environments and by the production rate of plastic worldwide, and those estimates have a large uncertainty in them. We then go to areas like the Great Pacific Plastic Patch and the North Pacific Gyre and gyres elsewhere around the world, the five major gyres, and we actually witness large accumulations of plastic, so this gives us some confidence in our previous estimates of the flux to the ocean. However, we really don't have good aerial coverage, direct observations around the world, and that's what this study has done. This team of international scientists led by scientists from Spain, Portugal, Australia, Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, Chile, and elsewhere took a research vessel and went all the way around the world visiting the major gyres as well as areas outside the gyre. And when they integrated their results globally, they concluded that we may have been overestimating the amount of plastic in the ocean by nearly 100-fold.
Despite the fact that we know that we produce about 300 million tons annually.
We produce a huge amount of plastic, and that production rate is going up every year, and the amount going into the ocean is presumably going up every year.
So that sort of brings back to us to the initial question of, so what happened to all this? I mean, we know it's not going to simply just disappear. It's fragmenting, but at such a rate that we can't really comprehend it yet?
Yeah, well, this study actually had a few thoughts on this and presented a few working hypotheses as to why there might be less plastic than we had previously thought. Of course, the amount of plastic at any one time is a balance between the amount that's coming into the ocean and the amount that's going out of the ocean. Up until this study, we really didn't think much about the sink for plastic. Where does the ocean dump its plastic? Is there a long-term sink in the deep sea or somewhere else? And what they showed is that the plastic is fragmenting into very small pieces, around 1 millimeter in size, maybe the size of the head of a straight pin. And these 1 millimeter size particles seem to be disappearing. And they presented a working hypothesis that perhaps small zooplankton were eating these plastic particles, larger fish were eating those zooplankton, and so on up the food web.
As that theory goes, that would say that maybe it's winding up perhaps with us. Is that too much of a stretch? Are these things, in fact, you know, recycling into the ocean?
Yeah, it's not impossible to think that the plastic is being concentrated up the food web. Of course, the larger you go up the food web, the fewer number of fish you have and the fewer number of top predators. It's unlikely that the plastic is being incorporated into their tissue. More likely, it's in their intestinal tracts, much like the problem with seabirds. This is potentially a problem. It's something that really needs to be looked at more carefully, and that's why this study appeared in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, a very high-profile scientific journal, to bring it to the general public and to the scientific community at large.
You helped to edit some of this, and as you were going through and looking at it, you must be asking yourself the same question that everyone is. Okay, so let's say it's moving through the gut of some of these animals. What happens then? Is it just simply sinking back into the ocean and not being recycled? Are other animals eating it? What's happening to it, and what happens as we put more and more into the ocean if, in fact, we do that?
Yeah, this is the big question. Mare incognita, the mystery of the sea. It's conceivable that this plastic, microplastic at this point, 1 millimeter in size and smaller, is being incorporated into the feces of the organisms, or maybe as the organisms die themselves, their bodies being transported to the deep sea. It's unclear exactly where the plastic would go once it gets into the deep sea. It still is buoyant. It's less dense than seawater. So even if it worked its way into the deep sea as a much larger, denser particle, once it's released as the microplastic, it would then float around the world's oceans and eventually make its way back up to the zone of constant density, perhaps the sea surface.
The bottom line is nothing goes away. I mean, it's going to be there. Whatever's put in there is going to stay there. But given the fact that this study has received so much attention with the idea that, well, there's a lot less plastic than we thought, what's your biggest fear about having a message like that out there?
Well, it's terrible. Dilution is not the solution to pollution, as we used to say in the 1960s. The ocean is not a big garbage dump. The fact that there is 100 times less plastic in the global ocean is going to, I think, send the wrong message to people who are trying very hard to clean up the ocean. This is going to be yet another challenge and a hurdle for them to get over.
What about its impact on other conservation groups as they're trying to put out a very different message to the rest of us?
Yeah, it's the same thing as the climate change issues. There are climate change deniers. There will be pollution deniers, and people will say plastic is not an issue, just like global warming is not an issue. These are false statements, of course. We need to bring more science into society. We need to educate the people. Our voters, these are the people that make the big decisions in society.
What do you see as the next step after this study?
Well, the next step, I think, is to do some controlled experiments, either in the laboratory or in large enclosures in the real world, in the ocean. Hawaii is perfectly situated for this. We have marine laboratories, and we have research vessels, and we in Seymour and in the new SCOPE program hope to get working on this very quickly.
Keep us posted. We want to know.
I'll be pleased to come back anytime.
Thanks very much, Dave. Dave Carl is the director of the Inouye Center for Microbial Oceanography Research and Education at the University of Hawaii. He's the co-director of the Simons Collaboration on Ocean Processes and Ecology. We'll be right back.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. It's 8:13. Coming up, the path to good health leads through the kitchen. But first, your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're recalling the life of one of those globe-trotting adventurers who often turn up in 19th century history. He'd been a gun runner in the Caribbean and was later thrown in jail in the Dutch East Indies after colonial authorities accused him of trying to start a rebellion. He escaped and found his way to the Utah Territory after getting permission from Brigham Young to set up a Mormon colony in the Pacific. He came to the islands as a Latter-day Saints missionary in 1861. He established a colony on Lanai where he bought large tracts of land in his own name with church funds. Charges of embezzlement and abuses of Mormon doctrine led to his excommunication, but that didn't slow him down. He went on to serve the monarchy as a member of the House of Representatives, Minister of Foreign Affairs, Attorney General, Minister of the Interior, and Secretary of War. Then in 1886, as Prime Minister of the Kingdom of Hawaii under King Kalakaua. It was quite a life, and today we're looking for his name. Call us if you know at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. We'll be back with your answer in the next half hour.
Good morning. I'm Susan Arnett from the State Office of the Public Defender. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Healthy cooking and healthy eating are a passion for Rebecca Woodland for good reason. Her vegetarian diet changed her life, may even have saved her life. So when she teaches her cooking classes, she's doing more than sharing recipes and techniques. She's offering a whole new way to look at the world, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Becky.
Good morning, Chris.
Is it fair to say that your shift in how you prepared and consumed food changed everything for you?
Pretty much, yes.
Well, how did it all come about?
Well, I had cancer, and it was quite apparent that my eating habits up to that point had been, in part, a contributing factor. Mm-hmm. And when I changed how I ate, the effect was so radical, not just for the cancer, but for the rest of my life. The headaches were much less. My complexion cleared. Sleep patterns were better.
A lot of things you didn't even think were related.
Yeah, things that I just figured, well, I'm getting older. Mm-hmm. I wasn't very old at the time, but yeah, you know, that's kind of what we think.
But it is easy to get into a pattern of sort of accepting the little aches and pains that come along.
Yes.
And you found out you didn't have to.
Right. Yeah. So I was really blessed that the results of my change in diet were quite apparent right away. Not everyone is like that, but for me, it really made a big difference.
Well, I know that when you're a cancer patient, there's certain foods they tell you are just accelerants, are that you know, cancer likes fat, cancer likes sugar.
Oh, yeah, cancer loves sugar. And sugar is in just about everything in the U.S., all the processed foods. And if you read the labels, it's pretty scary, especially when you realize what the labels really are saying. Yeah.
But in the course of consuming those foods over the course of a lifetime, you get some pretty built-in habits. Are they hard to break?
No. The thing is, you have to replace everything with something as good or better. Mm-hmm. If you just say, well, I'm not going to eat meat, I'm not going to eat sugar, I'm not going to eat this, pretty soon you're not eating at all, or you're just eating, you give up and you're eating junk.
And you're craving.
You're craving
yeah. everything that you gave
and
up.
And you have
like
no
crazy.
Social life either, which is, you know, and food is as much about fellowship as it is about just feeding yourself.
Well, does that get in the way for you now? I mean, when everybody goes out to a steakhouse or...
No, actually, there's a lot of good side dishes that are veg-friendly. So and when you get to know the chefs, one of my rules of thumb is I'm always suspicious of any restaurant or cafe or fast food place that has more than one of them. In other words, franchises and chains, that's kind of a red flag for me, because I know that they're less likely to accommodate my specific preferences. But when you get to know some of the chefs and you get familiar with the menus, and if I know I'm going out to a particular restaurant in a few days, I can email them and let them know, and they're very happy to accommodate and make adjustments as necessary. In fact, some of them really welcome the chance to be creative.
So you're not constrained by feeling like a special case?
No, I never act like I'm a special case. And when I go somewhere that's, you know, potluck, or where it would be, you know, fine for me to bring something, I bring something to share with everyone. And usually that's the first thing to go, because it's different and it's delicious and it's beautiful.
Well, I think the trick and the thing that keeps a lot of people away from going to a vegetarian diet is... And you've heard this said before, oh, it's going to be bland. I'm going to be bored to death. I'm going to crave my meat.
Well, that's just not true if you're actually preparing food deliciously. And when you stop to consider that many, in fact, I'd say most of the cuisines of the world that people say they love are not meat intensive. Meats are just used more as a condiment when they're used. Mm-hmm. And so you really focus on the flavor of the other ingredients, the vegetables and herbs and spices and things like that. And it's when you're using fresh ingredients prepared as freshly as possible, it's absolutely delicious. It really opened my world, because before I was thinking, you know, like your typical American, where you've got that brown thing on your plate, which is the meat, and then you've got the white thing, which is your starch, and then you have these little things in, you know, cubes or whatever that are called vegetables, and then you have a boring iceberg salad that you call a salad that has ranch dressing on it, which is a heart attack in a bottle, as far as I'm concerned. So that's not very healthy. But when you eliminate the meat, you have an opportunity to fill up on the good things, the nutritious vegetables and greens, the fiber, and it's much more satisfying, actually.
And you can also eat more of it, right?
Oh, you can eat a lot more of it, yes.
So is that a big part of what gets people in trouble with their diets, is they just sheer volume and feeling that meat has to take up a large percentage of that?
I don't know. I just know that a lot of times when you eat meat, you don't have any room left for the really good, healthy things, because you just feel full and heavy.
When you introduce your means of preparing food and consuming food to people, how difficult is it to make a convert?
Oh, once they taste it and they try to make it themselves, it's not hard. I mean, I'm not looking for converts, because it's not a religion. You know, some people act like it is. But, I think everybody would benefit from eating more plants. Everybody. I'm not saying you have to eat plants exclusively, but everybody will benefit from eating more plants. And one of the things in my classes, and this is something I hear after every class, and it's totally unsolicited, it comes from people of all ages, children, men, women, non-vegetarians, anybody. And at the end of the class, they go, I can do this. And they're so surprised that it's easy and it's absolutely delicious.
So that's a big perception coming in, that this is going to be a highly specialized skill they may or not be able
to. Yeah, and they think they're going to actually, I've had people come to my classes and actually have a dinner reservation waiting for them after class, because they're so sure they're going to still be hungry. And they end up canceling the reservation because they're just so happy with the food and so satisfied.
So let me go to a vegetarian cookie class and get a burger on the way home.
Yeah, yeah. It's crazy.
Hedge my
isn't
bets,
it?
Right?
That's exactly it. And then people realize that they don't need to do that anymore because this really, it's delicious and it's easy enough.
You're also emphasizing, I should have called them food preparation classes, because you're telling me that you're not doing a lot of cooking in the summer classes. Huh?
Right. And summer, well, in Hawaii, we're blessed with a year-round growing season. But in the summer, it's warmer, and we don't want to spend a lot more time in the kitchen over a hot stove. Being in a kitchen but not over a hot stove is a good thing. So the classes I'm doing in the summer are mostly, well, I call them heatless and meatless. Uh-huh. And so don't worry, you're not going to be eating, you know, veggie platter food and whatever those things are that, you know.
You can keep it interesting.
I can keep it very interesting. And every class includes a full meal, not just those little boring tasting portions, which don't give you any idea of how good it really is or how satisfying it can be.
Well, Becky, it's good to talk to you. Thanks very much for coming in.
Yes, and my next class is Thursday, July 10th, at the Manoa School of Art and Music in Manoa Marketplace. An advanced registration required. Check RebeccaWoodland.net.
All right, thanks, Becky. And as she just told you, those weekly cooking classes are Thursdays. You can learn more about them at hpr2.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bank of Hawaii, honored to be named one of America's best banks by Forbes for 5 consecutive years. Learn more at boh.com/bestbank. Member FDIC.
Making friends with endangered mountain gorillas in the Congo.
Before reaching the gorilla, you have just to give the signs, just to communicate with gorilla so that it can just remember that these guys, my friend, it's not the enemy.
But plenty of enemies still threaten the mountain gorillas. I'm Steve Kerwood. That's next time on Living on Earth from PRI.
This afternoon at 4, right after Fresh Air.
More and more station members are choosing sustaining membership as their preferred method of support. Thank you to Thomas and Astrid Jackson of Honolulu, Rochelle Ujibori of Kailua, and Eldon Wegner of Honolulu for helping HPR to plan for the future. Sustaining membership is an easy installment program of $5 or more per month, and it continues until you tell us otherwise. To find out more, contact the membership department at 955-8821, or you can visit the support page on hpr2.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting the Honolulu Surf Film Festival, now through July 31st at the Doris Duke Theater. Tickets online at honolulumuseum.org.
You might know Title IX as a gender equity law focused on parity of school athletic programs. The law is also supposed to protect students from sexual violence. A recent probe by the Federal Department of Education into dozens of colleges and universities included the University of Hawaii at Manoa. And while the results aren't yet public, the fact that the UH is on the list continues to fuel the idea that the school isn't doing enough. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us now with today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
You know, you probably have a lot of people say it'd be great to have the UH on a list with, say, Dartmouth, but not this kind of list.
No, 67 colleges and universities across the country that the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Education is looking into. And you're absolutely right. It's the part of Title IX that does require schools to protect students from sexual violence. You know, Aaliyah Wong, our education reporter, opens her story with an incident that happened in 2010 at UH Manoa. A young woman was sleeping in her dorm, and a coworker that she thought was a friend sexually assaulted her. Both of them, by the way, were RAs, resident advisors. Well, she reported it, but the administration may have botched the whole thing. They apparently made her feel victimized. One administrator actually encouraged her to stay friends with the guy. He transferred to another facility. And it turns out it was never brought up to the Honolulu Police Department. HPD actually encourages this. She may not have even been aware that option was available to her.
That seems to be where some of the problems lie, with not disclosing enough information to the victim. And some of the emails that went around that put a lot of the attention on the perpetrator.
Right. So getting raising awareness that there are options, that there are resources, is critical here into combating sex assaults on campus. I should tell you, in that incident I described, UH couldn't comment. It is a privacy matter involving a student. But underreporting also appears to be at the core of this problem, sexual misconduct problems at UH. You know, it's hard to estimate exactly how many there are. One estimate says 1 in 12 women experience sexual assault at campuses, but maybe only in fact, maybe it's actually double that number, but they're not reporting it because they don't know what to do. They feel confused or not having enough guidance.
Is there also an issue with the schools just in general not taking it seriously enough? Because in the incident you talked about a moment ago, it seems as if it's not looked at very seriously.
I think on the part of UH, they do certainly consider it quite seriously. They've tried to improve security, having better lighting, having the guards report these things, show up when an incident does happen. But there's still some sense that there's foot dragging. Right now, UH is revising its policies, and the faculty union is reviewing changes to their policies and procedures.
Because prevention is a whole lot better than having to deal with the aftermath of an event like that. We're going to leave it there for the moment. Keep checking in, see how this develops once these results are made public. Thanks so much, Chad.
Of course. Thanks, Bethann.
Talk to you in the morning. Chad Blair writes on politics for civilbeat.com.
Good morning. I'm Chris Vandercook, and it's 8:30. You're tuned to The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Later, another perspective on plans for Kauai Nui Marsh, but first, this news from the BBC. Tonight at 5, it's The Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak. And Kathy, there's a new protocol regarding breast cancer screenings, yeah?
Well, we're looking at a lot of different data. Some of them suggest that people should do 3D mammograms. Some of them say that the standard mammography is adequate. We're also going to talk with a woman who is a breast surgeon who started off in basic science research, because in addition to determining and screening if someone has breast cancer, there's a whole new modality that probably in the next 5 or 10 years is going to completely change how we treat breast cancer.
That being personalized tumor genetics?
Absolutely. Looking at people's individual cancers and tumors and saying, what if we could test to see what chemotherapy this tumor responds to on the tumor, not on the patient? And that would save them a lot of heartbreak, a lot of time, a lot of effort, but also a lot of side effects of chemotherapy. Also, they're looking at trying to develop different ways to have antibodies that you can create to that specific tumor and use that. So there's a lot that's going on in the realm of breast cancer, and we're going to talk with somebody who's right in the middle of it and sort of have them help us to figure out what's going on now, what's in the next couple of years, and what's distant in the future.
So, Kathy, it sounds as if this new approach allows the physician to be more specific about how they attack a tumor?
Need to, because, you know, they always say one size fits all means one size really doesn't fit anybody. Yeah. And a lot of the protocols for what we do right now are somewhat individualized, but not enough. And so different people wind up with entirely different tumors getting the same therapy. And some of them are going to have good response, and some of them won't have any. And we want to minimize side effects for folks by trying to give them an opportunity to really personalize their treatment.
Well, it's certainly of concern to a lot of people, Kathy, so we'll encourage them to call in, and that's the Body Show with Dr. Kathy Kozak tonight at 5.
The plan to develop Hawaii's largest wetland is causing upset in the Kailua community, as we heard last week from the president of the Hawaii Audubon Society. But the plan is also causing consternation for the state. DLNR wildlife biologist Jim Cogswell is in charge of the Kawanui Marsh. He says Linda Paul was inaccurate when we spoke with her and that she made several erroneous assumptions. He's in our studio this morning to discuss his list. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, thanks for being here. One of the underlying issues with a lot of organizations and people who have been working on this, too, is that somehow the community has gotten shut out from the draft plan as it exists now. That seems to be the bottom line for them. We can talk about specifics in a second, but I'd like to ask you to be able to respond to this idea that somehow the community is not has not been really part of this plan as it's evidenced in the draft.
I would differ with that assumption because we have spent the last 2 years, in fact, working on this draft, holding public meetings that were publicized to a wide number of our stakeholders. We've talked with many individuals, many of the groups that are concerned, Audubon Society, one of them, the Kailua Neighborhood Board, spoken to them on several occasions. We are listening, and every time we get together and look at the plan, we're actually making modifications in response to what we're hearing, modifying it as much as we think is possible.
For those who say, though, that you know we just don't need to have the marsh developed, let it just be a wetland, that
yeah.
clearly is not in your plan.
Well, idyllically, that would be perfect, and I would love it. And, you know, if we can assume that the marsh is going to restore itself, okay. If we can assume that DOFA and myself can actually handle all the restoration needed without the support and help of the community, okay. If the marsh didn't play a central role in the Hawaiian community and Hawaiian culture, then okay. If there are other ways to completely engage youth in learning and being passionate about the environment other than letting them get knee-deep in marsh, then okay. If we can assume that increasing residents and visitors coming to Kailua to enjoy the beaches and get away from Honolulu will not spill over and strain the infrastructure already in place in Kailua and will not interfere with our core priorities, which is restoration of ecosystem services, flood control, water quality, restoring wildlife populations, and providing the cultural components that are missing in the Kailua, Hamakua, Kauai Nui area. And if, yeah, so I think.
So your bottom line really is that to not do any of those things would be opportunities seriously missed.
Seriously missed.
And that if it can be managed appropriately, then why not?
Yeah, and in fact, it would jeopardize what is already there and further put in peril the situation in the marsh.
The question of where exactly everything goes was also an issue for her and for other groups, too, Hawaii's Thousand Friends and others, who've said, okay, where those buildings look like they would be going in the plan as it exists now is on the upslope. Why not put them closer to where they would be able to integrate with infrastructure already there?
Yeah. There is a good portion of infrastructure already in place, water lines, sewage systems in areas like our base yard below the Castle Medical Center and that sort of thing. There are also plenty of examples in the world of appropriate ways of being able to provide those basic infrastructure needs without hooking up necessarily to the public waste system or electric or water. There's water catchment systems that could be used, solar panels that could be used, composting toilets, can be used, and all this will be examined in the next phase of the process of creating this master plan, which is the environmental impact study. And those options and alternatives will be examined in detail, and we'll know then our limits of what we can do, where it is appropriate, if it's not appropriate where we've proposed according to the environmental impact statement and further comments from the public. We can move it. It's a draft plan at this moment, and it's...
So you don't see that as being a stumbling block at all, that it's just where it happens to be placed at the moment, but you'd certainly be open to moving it if that seemed to be the best thing to do.
And in fact, I think it's great that we're thinking of it, and some people see it as conflict, but in fact, we're all starting from the same basic priorities. We want to get Kauai Nui Marsh restored. We want to see those water birds' numbers increase, and we want to see Hawaiian culture being practiced. We want to see our children educated and become passionate about the environment themselves.
Meanwhile, you've got to manage all of this, and that means that you have to move around it. You've got to be able to traverse it. What about that road?
The road in question is currently part of the draft master plan. It's referred to in the master plan actually as a maintenance access. In the past, there was an actual road there used by the ranchers in Kauai Nui Marsh, and our idea was rather than constantly be transporting heavy equipment on a daily basis back and forth over the highway between the Kahanaiki side below Le Jardin Academy and our current base yard below the Castle Medical Center, we could use amphibious tractors, which we're going to get, and be able to, without paving the road, building bridges, or even using gravel to reinforce, simply maintain a path along the vegetation that we can easily access one side to the other without an environmental impact. And again, the environmental impact assessment will assess the impact of this...
Of that tractor
and of the maintenance path that we're envisioning.
One more thing before we have to say goodbye to you, because I know we're running short on time, but the idea that the ponds are becoming anaerobic and stinky.
Yeah, I was surprised to hear that, because working down there on a daily basis, we've been managing that situation. They are not stinky. They are in very good health. We've got a monitoring program, water monitoring program, that gives us 24/7 water monitoring data, water quality data, that allows us to react immediately once a situation presents itself. But stinky water, that is a common thing in marshes. That's just a natural process.
It just happens.
It just happens. It's a matter of mitigating the impact of that afterwards.
All right. Well, we have lots more to talk about, and thankfully we'll have other times to be able to do it. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for inviting me.
Jim Cogswell is a wildlife biologist with the Department of Land and Natural Resources Division of Forestry and Wildlife.
Today's Backyard Quiz, we talked about a 19th century adventurer who made his mark on Hawaii in religion, journalism, and government. He came to the islands to start a Mormon colony on the island of Lanai. The problem was he bought the land with church funds but registered it under his own name. That eventually got him excommunicated for embezzlement. Undaunted, he turned his energies toward local media and politics, starting his first newspaper, the New Ho, in 1873. In 1878, he won election of the House of Representatives, and in 1880, he bought the Pacific Commercial Advertiser, the forerunner of Honolulu's current morning paper. He later served the monarchy in appointed positions, including the posts of Minister of Foreign Affairs and Prime Minister of the Kingdom during the reign of King Kalākaua. His fortunes fell quickly after his appointment as prime minister. He encouraged the king to chase dreams of a Pan-Pacific empire, an idea that turned Hawaii's international allies and the local business community against him. Today we ask you to name the man driven from office and forced to flee the islands. Walter Murray Gibson died penniless in 1889. It's 8:45, and that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for today's programming comes from the Joy of Sake, a sake celebration featuring more than 370 sakes to taste and sake-friendly appetizers from 19 restaurants, July 18th at the Hawaii Convention Center, joyofsake.com.
It's time for Stargazer. Aloha, I'm Dave Lawrence, and it's our weekly update of what's happening in our island skies, plus we hear what's going on in the world of astronomy as well. We turn to Christopher Phillips, Emilo Astronomy Center in Hilo, our official connection to the Mauna Kea Summit Research Community. Hey, Christopher, what's happening this week?
Hey, Dave, it's good to be back. For this week's Stargazers, we have the trio of bright planets, Jupiter, Mars, and Saturn, in our island skies. These planets are going to be very easy to spot as they'll be located high in the southern sky, and these guys are going to be with us pretty much all through summertime. The moon is going to be full at the end of the week, so unfortunately this means that spotting those faint stars and meteors is going to be very tricky. But the good news is that we are not expecting any passes of the International Space Station this week, so we shouldn't be missing out on too much.
That's good to know. And speaking of the ISS, no doubt something they'd be interested in as well, and that is eavesdropping on alien signals. Is that what we're talking about this week?
That's right, Dave. The Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, that's the SETI program, recently announced two new methods for searching for signals that could come from life on other planets. The first project is the Panchromatic SETI project, where multiple telescopes will scan a variety of wavelengths from 30 of the nearest stars. SETI is also launching an interplanetary eavesdropping program that is expected to search for messages beamed between two planets in a single star system. Now, eavesdropping on alien signals may sound far-fetched, but let's just think about our own signals for a moment. Ever since the invention of high-powered radio, our transmissions have been leaking out into space for around 100 years, and they are traveling outward toward the stars at the speed of light. Now, many of our own transmissions have passed by potentially habitable star systems. So, if someone out there has a radio, they could tune in and listen to Radio Planet Earth. In a few years, they could even be tuning into episodes of HBR's very own Stargazer.
Hey, Christopher, when it comes to SETI, which is a lot of people know as its own organization, are they connected at all with the government, or where do they get their funding?
Actually, SETI has no government funding whatsoever.
Okay.
It's purely a private venture, so it relies on the donations from good-willing individuals.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate the heads up, and we'll certainly keep one ear cocked for alien signals ourselves. Christopher Phillips, Emilo Astronomy Center in Hilo.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
You are welcome. And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week here for Stargazer.
Large-scale sugar production began in Koloa, Kauai, 179 years ago, changing life in the islands forever. Koloa Plantation was the model for plantation communities that followed, and you can still feel the history all around you there. For 25 years, Koloa Plantation Days, coming up later this month, has celebrated that history, and Melissa McFerrin, who's coordinating the 7 days of events, is on the line to tell us more. Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning, Chris.
There's
How
an awful
are you
lot-
this fine day?
Oh, I'm pretty good. It's hard to tell because we're in here in a windowless room, but I think it probably is a pretty fine day out there.
Yes, well, Koloa is looking beautiful, and preparations are now underway for our 10 days of events coming up this month, July 18th through July 27th, celebrating and commemorating Koloa's plantation history.
Did you grow up there?
Actually, I did not, but I grew up in Boston.
Uh-huh.
Where many of the first missionaries came from. So there's a real appreciation for the history here and the stories. And as a matter of fact, most of the residents here and the local culture here came from immigration. So in addition to our host culture, Kaloa Plantation Day celebrates the different immigrant cultures that came here from China, from Japan, from Portugal, and most recently the Philippines. And so when you experience local culture here, you get to taste the flavors, hear the music, see the dances, and listen to the talk stories of what it was like to grow up on the plantation and how these different cultures were shared.
Are there still a lot of people around who can tell their firsthand stories of what it was like?
Oh, absolutely. Actually, our president of Kaloa Plantation Days, her husband, Mayor Tony Kunimura, started the festival 29 years ago, and some of the members of the board were here from then. Then we have talk stories, for instance, with Pastor Niles Kagayama of Kaloa Missionary Church, who talks about growing up in the camps and what that experience was like. And this year we have David Penhalo Scott in a talk story where he's talking about plantation society at the time of Pearl Harbor. He is a descendant of the former governor.
So there was kind of a social hierarchy in plantation days, the owners, the workers, and there was a kind of a high society you're talking about.
Well, there was different societies going on, and a lot of what we do focuses on all the different aspects of it, from the technical. For instance, we have an exhibit going on throughout the week at the shops at Kukuiula that has photography, which encompasses the mill itself, from the old Kaloa mill, 100 years of photography from Grove Farm Homestead, and then the most recent photography of the last plantation camp over in Kamakani, which was the Filipino migration, which came over in the 40s. So it's really a rich and evolving history. And by sharing and telling the stories and celebrating and commemorating, that's how we keep it alive and pass it on to the next generation.
Melissa, when you hear the talk story memories, what are some of the characteristics of those memories, the stories that people tell you?
Well, one of the things we ask is, what have you learned that you want to share, or what made this different? And they said, what sugar brought to Kauai, and I would imagine Hawaii, was the people. And they talk about the food and sharing the bento boxes in the fields, and that's how local cuisine got started, because you'd be mixing different dishes, and people would come in with their different dishes, and even the language started with people who spoke other languages, and then having this shorthand, that a lot of these phrases came from those times.
And in those memories, you have a lot of different cultures intersecting, as you said.
Absolutely. And part of what it also captures, besides the people and the culture, is also the area, because we've changed so much over the years, and we still maintain that rural character here on Kauai. But to hear the stories of riding horseback down to where National Tropical Botanical Garden is now and asking, could we please swim on your beach? And to have the stories of the train, and Grove Farm brings in the Paolo, which is a original sugarcane train, which is restored, and they bring the engine down for the parade and park event on July 26th, which is really the first event. It all got started with one event, and then it has built out and grown together with the participation of area businesses, community groups, and the visitor industry into a 10-day festival of over 30 events.
There's always in a community with a lot of history, Melissa, there's always that kind of pressure to preserve, working against, the need, I guess you'd say, to modernize. Do you feel a little bit of that where you live?
Well, I would say that there's a huge interest in authenticity. For instance, even when things are created that are newer, there is the thought of how do we continue to telling the story, because it is their history that makes us different and unique. For instance, when we did, we do a historic film night together with the exhibit opening, and we had people come down and say, hey, I was here in the camp at Kiahuna Plantation Camp, and now we have beautiful amenities and we have different experiences, but it's really trying to bring in that plantation feel. And I do think that that is something that our community here shares and our visitor industry shares, to really keep that alive and keep that as a living, breathing entity. So like through Kaloa Plantation Days, we get so many visitors that visit us to experience this, whether from the state or international, and we direct them to other resources where they can learn more. For instance, the Kauai Museum, Grove Farm Homestead, and the Kauai Historical Society. So we hope that by being out there and doing something fun and interactive that people will gravitate toward, whether it's plantation games with your keiki, or whether it's a talk story, or even a craft show showcasing some of these traditional crafts, or a historic exhibit and film night, or the live music, that we can bring it back to that central message that this is a unique and special place, and this history is worth perpetuating and celebrating.
Well, it sounds as if that's very much the fact. Thanks very much, Melissa.
Thank you. And for more information on the festival, if you'd like to find out
Melissa,
more,
we'll send
we
them
do
your
have
way.
A comprehensive website at Kaloa Plantation Days.
Melissa McFerrin is the coordinator of Kaloa Plantation Days, and the events run from July 18th on in Poipu. You can get details at hpr2.org.
This morning we had a great deal to consider on a global level and certainly locally.
Globally, and yes, exactly. Having a lot to do with our history, but also where we're going, yeah?
And the fact that we know that, you know, these things don't evaporate when we're talking about plastics. What we may know about it may be incomplete, but asking a lot more questions, this latest study looking at where did all the plastic go, what's happening to it. And as we are here in Hawaii, looking at the rest of the world and not just myopically training on certain parts of it.
Well, that plastic story was troubling because it did not vanish into thin air.
Well, that's just the whole point. There's just so many more questions we don't know that scientists are continuing to probe. And we'll talk more about it as we get some more answers, if in fact we get answers anytime soon about that. That's going to do it for us for this Monday morning. Now, after months of hearings, tomorrow we're going to get a Hawaii State Hospital update with Senator Josh Green.
And the Actors Group brings pre-Civil War history to life on stage.
We'd like to hear from you, too. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you want everybody else to know what you have to say, you can post your comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation, or tweet your thoughts at HI Conversation, or reach me at BKOZHPR.
All our past shows are on the HPR2 archive, so are links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HPR2.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you in the morning for more of The Conversation.